Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the U.S. is definitely complicit in the Israeli regime's brutal aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. Ayatollah Khamenei said the successive arrival of the heads of oppressive and villainous states, such as the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany, in Israel, bespeaks their concerns about the collapse of the Zionist regime. He added that they reach there to avoid the destruction of Israel. Iran's leader added that their apprehension shows that the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas was a crushing and decisive one. He stressed that Islamic countries should not be passive in the face of criminals. He said that Palestine would definitely emerge victorious. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing a gathering in Tehran. Israel continues its bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip as more Palestinians fall victim to deadly airstrikes. The health ministry in Gaza says about 700 Palestinians, including at least 300 children, were killed in the past 24 hours. 50 people were killed in a single hour due to the intensity of the attacks. Israel's war on Gaza is now in its 19th day. Over 6,500 Palestinians have been killed and 18,000 injured so far. The head of the Hamas media office says Israel has bombed Gaza with more than 12,000 tons of explosives. He says this is equivalent to the power of the nuclear bomb that was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The regime's strikes are coupled with a crippling siege of Gaza. Israel has also barred any fuel transport into the Strip. This has left hospitals increasingly unable to treat the injured due to the need for fuel to run power generators.
Health institutions in the Gaza Strip depend very heavily on electrical generators to generate electricity and operate the necessary equipment for patients and injured people. Now, there is a complete power outage and we rely heavily on electrical generators. As everyone knows, intensive care and operations departments operate all their equipment with electricity. And if the fuel runs out, we will condemn the patients in the intensive care departments to inevitable death.
The World Health Organization has warned without vital fuel and additional health supplies, thousands of vulnerable patients in Gaza will be at risk. The WHO said that it is unable to distribute fuel and life-saving aid to major hospitals in northern Gaza. Added that six hospitals across Gaza have already been shut down due to the lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, warned that it would be forced to stop working across the Gaza Strip unless there were urgent fuel deliveries to the territory. The leaders of Lebanese and Palestinian resistance movements have held a meeting to discuss the developments in the Gaza Strip. According to the Lebanese Al-Manar TV, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah met with the Hamas deputy head Saleh al-Aruri and the Islamic Jihad's chief Ziad al-Nakhala. The three leaders evaluated the future course of action by the resistance front to achieve a real victory against Israel. They also discussed ways to stop Israeli bloodshed in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The trio also talked about regional and global stances on Gaza. They agreed to improve coordination and cooperation in the face of Israeli brutalities against the Palestinians. Diplomats from other countries at the UN Security Council have also reacted to Israel's carnage in Gaza. Turkey has said turning a blind eye to the crimes committed against the Palestinian people amounts to sheer hypocrisy.
Some prefer to look the other way in face of such atrocities. They prefer not to speak about crimes against humanity and war crimes. They prefer to pretend as if Palestinian people are just numbers and they have no souls and rights. This is absolutely unacceptable. This is sheer hypocrisy and embodiment of double standard that constitutes the very root cause of the problem we are facing today. Cessation of hostilities must be achieved through an immediate, unconditional, and lasting ceasefire.
Speaking at the meeting, the Jordanian foreign minister accused Israel of violating international law and running roughshod over the Security Council resolutions. The Egyptian foreign minister called for ending the forced displacement of the Palestinians in Gaza. The top Saudi diplomat demanded an end to Israel's military operations and warned against the dangerous consequences of double standards and selective avoidance by the UN laws and resolutions. Qatar's UN envoy also delivered a speech at the Security Council session.
It is deplorable that the Security Council has not been able to adopt a resolution to put an end to this crisis, and we still hope that the Council will shoulder its responsibility under the UN Charter regarding the maintenance of international peace and security. In recent times, the Security Council has heard different appeals that reaffirm the fact that incomplete solutions lead to this spiral of violence. And we are seeing a new spiral of violence, which confirms once again that the only way of achieving lasting peace in the region is to find a just and lasting solution to the Palestinian question.
The Secretary General of the Arab League also warned that the credibility of the UN Security Council is at stake. Ahmed Abulghait said that Israeli strikes on Gaza are tantamount to the collective punishment of Palestinians. The UN Secretary General also slammed Israel for violating international law on the Gaza Strip.
I'm deeply concerned about the clear violations of international humanitarian law that we are witnessing in Gaza. Let me be clear, no party to an armed conflict is above international humanitarian law. It is important to also recognize the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation. They have seen their land steadily devoured by settlements and plagued by violence, their economy stifled, their people displaced, and their homes demolished. Their hopes for a political solution to their plight have been vanishing.
UN Chief's remarks have enraged Israel. In a press conference, the regime's UN envoy said that Guterres is, quote, not fit to lead the organization, and called on him to resign. The regime has also refused to issue visas to UN officials to, quote, teach them a lesson. Patrick Henningsen is a geopolitical analyst who joins us from Los Angeles. Patrick Henningsen, welcome to the program. I'm not too sure if I should ask you the question about what has been the statement that came from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and the harsh response by Israel, which we understand is so enraged that it won't issue visas. I mean, Guterres has basically, in the midst of some of the statements, said a basic fact that everyone is aware of. Why is it that Israel wants to, not just the reaction, but wants to, in a sense, to deny the fact that Guterres put out there in terms of the state of the Palestinians, in particular in the Gaza Strip?
What the Secretary General did was put the issue into context. He's one of the first people to do this publicly. But this is kind of forbidden in Western dialogue right now, because Israel believes, because they have the backing of the United States and the EU, they believe they are somehow omnipotent. And then when anyone else speaks about their issue, they can't put it into historical context. They accuse them of all sorts of epithets, and they throw tantrums and make threats. But basically, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres should have called for a ceasefire within 48 hours of the hostilities, which began 2 weeks ago. But he didn't. He's come late to the game. But we welcome this call from the UN and putting it into historical context so people realize this is not an unprovoked incident on October 7th. This is one in a long series of events that goes back 75 years. So that's all he did, was put it into proper historical context. And for that, you get the political backlash from the Israeli delegation and silence from Washington. Why isn't Washington calling for a ceasefire? Why isn't Britain calling for a ceasefire? Nobody's calling for a ceasefire. The only country that tabled any such motion, the UN Security Council, is really the Russian Federation and the other partners on the draft text of that last week. So it's kind of a shameful incident in international relations whereby the leading world powers are not calling for a ceasefire. They're calling for more war. And the human cost is just incalculable. The bodies are piling up as we speak. The international community needs to act now to save lives in Gaza.
Do you think that the worldwide support that we have seen on the streets is a sign that they're not taking Israel in any shape or form to its word? And not only that, that now it is widening the gulf that exists in terms of the support for Palestinians on the streets as opposed to not only Israel, but the way that these world leaders, as you call them, are coming out in support of Israel. Isn't that kind of dangerous here? Because we're seeing a breakdown in terms of, on the one hand, international organizations not being able to do anything, and then, okay, then we the people are looking for their leaders to do something for the Palestinians, and then they're seeing their leaders, just as you said, they want this war somewhat to continue. They can't even call for a ceasefire.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head right there. It's the gulf between government leaders, the mainstream media, and the actual people. As you see globally, more and more, the support for the Palestinian resistance struggle, the national cause, the end of oppression, the end of the occupation, this is growing globally by the day. The numbers are unbelievable. We didn't even see these types of numbers in major anti-war protests in recent years. And yet here we are. There's a big gulf between where the people are in the world, especially in the global south, but not just there. This is across Europe. This is in New York. This is in the United States, college campuses across North America. Their voice and the solidarity is like unmistakable. So you have leaders and the mainstream media. You have the Israeli lobby on one hand, and it's a small but powerful minority of voices, and influential, sure. But then you have the overwhelming populace. The global voice is huge. So that massive gulf between where the people are with the Palestinians, but leaders in the media are not. And hopefully we will see that gulf closing as the situation continues to become more grave by the day. It shouldn't have to come to this. The global leaders should have recognized their responsibility from the onset. And the mainstream media, their performance, their complicity in the war crimes, in the crimes against humanity that we're all witnessing live on television, is shameful in the extreme. We've never seen anything like this in our lifetime. To see a genocide play out on live TV, and nobody from any political leader in the G7 is speaking up to stop it. This is unprecedented.
All right, let's bring in a correspondent, Mona Kandil, from occupied Ramallah, who joins us now to tell us about the ongoings in the occupied territories and a lot more. Mona, go ahead. It's all yours.
Unfortunately, while I was preparing myself to speak about the martyrs here in the occupied West Bank, I've just received a call from my relatives in Gaza Strip, from my cousin, telling me that the area where they had to flee to was bombed. The house was bombed by Israeli airstrike. My uncle is in serious condition, his two sons as well. And unfortunately, his wife was martyred. My uncle's wife was martyred. And my cousin was screaming. At the first, she thought that all the family members were martyred. However, then she knew that only her mom was martyred. My uncle and the son and his sons are in serious condition. Other family members are also had been wounded, and neighbors were also wounded. I have to say that this family, my cousin, my dad's brother, had to take his family from Al-Auda area in northern the Gaza Strip. He took his family first to Jabalia, then to Beit Lahia. Then because of the bombing and the airstrikes, he took his family to Rafah. And then there were a lot of airstrikes in that area in Rafah as well. Several days ago, he went to Al-Ibrej, it's near the south of the Gaza Strip. However, just less than 1 hour from now, Israeli airstrikes targeted several houses. As we know, they're in the refugee camp of Al-Ibrej. And as we know also from relatives there, it's yet another massacre. Many Palestinians had been killed, including women and children. Those people accepted, let's say, the Israeli orders as they were, and warnings and threats that you have to leave northern the Gaza Strip and flee to the south. They went to the south looking for refuge. They went to the south in order to make sure that none of them would be hurt. However, the Israeli military continued bombarding all the Gaza Strip. The issue is not about the north or the south. All Palestinians are being targeted. Those are civilians. My uncle had a small restaurant. He was a cook. His wife also made food for the people. So they were civilians. They didn't do anything. Just they are people living in the Gaza Strip. I pray now that my uncle will be okay. And I'm hoping that he will not be martyred, not he or any of his family members, other family members.
All right, Mona, again, my condolences there. And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. A federal indictment charging former U.S. President Donald Trump with trying to stay in power after losing the 2020 presidential election includes detailed charges of Trump and his co-conspirators' pressure on individual state officials. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. As Donald Trump faces criminal charges in multiple cases across the country, several states are still investigating a scheme created by Trump allies and boosted by Donald Trump himself to cast fake electoral votes for the Republican candidate for the 2020 election. As part of the U.S. Electoral College system, states cast a set number of votes for the candidate who wins the popular vote in their state, the winner of which then takes the presidency. Seven states that the former president lost saw slates of fake GOP electors falsely claim that Donald Trump had won their electoral votes. These fake electors included high-profile Republicans, such as sitting office holders and state party leaders. Two prosecutors in Michigan and Georgia have already filed charges against fake electors. Others have confirmed investigations but provided few details. One state prosecutor said local laws did not address this kind of crime, which is unprecedented. Kenneth Chesbrough, a Trump campaign legal advisor and a supposed mastermind of the fake electoral scheme, pleaded guilty in Georgia over his role in subverting the election. Chesbrough created the plan in a secret memo based on Wisconsin's electoral vote. At the federal level, the special counsel Jack Smith and his team brought charges against Donald Trump and his allies over their attempts to overturn the 2020 election results, which include the fake electoral scheme. Several states have confirmed they are cooperating with Jack Smith's investigation, and news reports have indicated that Jack Smith offered limited immunity to some fake electors for their testimony. The New York Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. The federal indictment charging former U.S. President Donald Trump with trying to stay in power after losing the 2020 presidential election includes detailed charges of Donald Trump and his co-conspirators' pressure on individual state officials. Since the scheme had no precedent, some states and experts have struggled to figure out which laws may have been broken and whether the charges should be state or federal. In some states, the fake electors also face civil lawsuits. And here's where they stand. The former Arizona Attorney General, Mark Brnovich, a Republican, never publicly confirmed any investigation into the state's fake electors, which included high-profile far-right figures such as the state senator Jake Hoffman and the former Arizona GOP chair Kelly Ward. The state actually saw two separate sets of fake electors. His successor, the Democrat Chris Mays, said earlier this year that her office is investigating the fake electors, but has not provided any details of the investigation so far. On a recent Arizona Republic podcast episode, Chris Mays said she could not say much about the contours of the investigation, but that her office was taking it very seriously and that it was a very important investigation. While the cases in Michigan and Georgia are much further along, she noted that their prosecutors have been in place much longer than she has. Chris Mays took office in January of 2023. Three fake electors in Georgia were charged as part of a broader case against Donald Trump and his allies over election subversion attempts. The Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis brought charges against the former Georgia Republican Party chairman David Schaefer, the state senator Sean Steele, and the activist Kathy Latham, three of the 16 fake electors from that state. They face various charges including forgery, impersonating a public officer, and attempting to file false documents. Several of the others who signed on as false electors for Donald Trump struck immunity deals or plea agreements with prosecutors. The three fake electors charged have pleaded not guilty. Their attorneys argued in September that they were not fake electors, but instead contingent electors who could be used should the courts overturn Biden's win. The three are trying to get their case moved from state court in Georgia to a federal court, arguing they were acting as federal officers who were keeping an avenue open for Donald Trump, depending on what happened in the courts of law. Sidney Powell, who was charged in the broader case, pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with the prosecution. The unexpected move netted Powell 6 years of probation and some fines and marks a major shift in the Georgia case for Donald Trump and his allies. Kenneth Chesbrough, on the day jury selection for his trial was set to begin, pleaded guilty to a felony charge of conspiracy to commit filing false documents and probably will serve 5 years probation. The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Democratic Attorney General Donna Nessel charged 16 Michiganders who participated as fake electors with 8 felonies each, including multiple forgery charges, for their role in the scheme. Those charged include party activists, candidates for office, and state and local party officials. The Democratic Attorney General Donna Nessel charged 16 Michiganders who participated as fake electors with 8 felonies each, including multiple forgery charges, for their roles in the scheme. Attempts by 2 defendants to get the charges dismissed because of Nessel's comments about how the electors were brainwashed were unsuccessful. The 16 people charged pleaded not guilty, and probable cause hearings are set for this month. Recently, court filings from the Attorney General's office obtained by NBC News show one of Michigan's fake electors saw his charges dropped as part of a deal with the state's attorney general. James Renner, a Republican who falsely signed that Donald Trump had won, agreed to full cooperation, truthful testimony, and production of any and all relevant documents in exchange for the dropped charges. This includes information about how he was asked to become part of the fake electoral scheme and the circumstances of meetings among those involved in the scheme. Nevada's top prosecutor has said his office would not bring charges against the six people who signed on as fake electors in Nevada in 2020. The state's Democratic Attorney General, Aaron Ford, said current state laws did not address this kind of situation, to the dismay of some and I'm sure to the delight of others. The Democratic State Senator, Skip Daley, attempted to solve that problem, and the state legislature passed a bill that would have made it a felony for people to serve as false electors, punishable by up to 10 years imprisonment. Aaron Ford has endorsed the bill. But the Republican governor of Nevada, Joe Lombardo, has vetoed the bill, saying the penalties were too harsh, though he said he believed those who undermine elections should face strict punishments. According to Source New Mexico, the former New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas started an investigation into the five Republicans who signed as false electors there, then referred the matter to federal prosecutors. The office of the current Attorney General, Raul Torres, confirmed there was an active state investigation into the fake electors to see if they violated state laws, but details about the case have been scant. According to KOAT Action News, Torres's office said it would work with Special Counsel Jack Smith to get any evidence related to a state inquiry. Like Pennsylvania, the fake electors in New Mexico included a caveat in their documents that could help them should charges be filed. They wrote that they signed the documents under understanding that it might be later determined that we are the duly elected and qualified electors. The 20 fake electors in Pennsylvania are unlikely to face any criminal charges because of how they worded the documents that they signed. The documents say the false electoral votes would only be considered valid if the courts deemed the slate to be the duly elected and qualified electors for Pennsylvania.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the different effects of supplication. We said that supplication has many effects and advantages that we are mostly unaware of, but by getting to know the different aspects of effects of supplication, we can learn more from these supplications, specifically from the transmitted ones. These supplications fill out the gaps in human nature as well as the mental gaps. They also cause belief in the Almighty Allah as well as bringing in self-recognition and self-belief. And by knowing the fact that the very engagement in supplication is, of course, a blessing by the Almighty Allah that we need to be grateful for, we can understand that our supplications are mostly responded to, and we can at least claim that all of our supplications are responded to, but of course some of them are not superficially answered. Another effect of supplication that we were discussing was the fact that by seeing these embodiments of spirituality, by seeing these perfect men injecting all these schools, all these thoughts and lessons in their supplications, even seeing these perfect men will educate, will cause us to be educated. And this is the fact that these supplications actually reveal to us that we can be from among the perfect men as well. This is because Islam is not a series of words to be uttered only. These supplications are not just to be read, or not just to be recited and not thought over, not pondered upon. Without considering the contents behind prayers and supplications, we cannot reach anything. For instance, the prayer that we perform every day, it is of course a complex set of concepts in which all human positions are considered and man is invited to go towards them. In the Sha'baniya supplication, we are told to ask God like this, إِلَهِ هَبْلِي كَمَالَ الْإِنْقِطَاعِ إِلَيْكِ. O God, grant me to devote myself to you only. وَأَنِرْ أَبْصَارَ قُلُوبِنَا بِضِيَاءِ نَظَرِهَا إِلَيْكِ. Light the sights of our hearts with the light of seeing you. حَتَّى تَخْرِقَ أَبْصَارُ الْقُلُوبِ حُجَبَ النُّورِ. Until the sights of the hearts pierce the screens of light. فَتَصِلَ إِلَى مَعْدِنِ الْعَظَمَ وَتَصِيرَ أَرْوَاحُنَا مُعَلَّقَةٌ بِعِزِّ قُدْسِكِ. Such that our souls become hung with the glory of your holiness. We also read, إِلَهِ وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِنُورِ عِزِّكَ الْأَبْهَجِ. O my God, let me reach the light of your bright glory. فَأَكُونَ لَكَ عَارِفًا. So I can get to recognize you. وَعَنْ سِوَاكَ مُنْحَرِفًا. So I can divert from anyone other than you. This is the supplication. Supplication is an invitation to the highest degree of the position which is assumed for a Gnostic. And of course, it is good news for people who know that the doors leading to perfection are always open.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil, javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, That is where the answer will come. Harakujokeshti. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ob kamju tishnagi ovarbedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Tabeju shad obaz balova as. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Brothers and sisters, based on what we have said so far about the different effects of supplication, some people will falsely believe that, of course, these effects, these advantages are reached even if we recite these words without thinking. There are, of course, some hindrances on the way to supplication that we need to be aware of. In Imam Ali's Kumail supplication, we read that there are some obstacles on the way of supplication, which if we are not removing them, I mean, if the supplicant is not removing them, there will be no response to the supplication. Imam Ali alayhi salam has referred to these significant conditions through this statement. Oh my God, forgive my sins that invalidate the supplication. This very sentence indicates that the major hindrances on the way of supplications are sins. Then he has ordered us to ask for pardon to cure this situation. Concerning this issue, there is a tradition narrated by Ma'ad ibn Jabal from Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, referring to the major obstacles on the way of supplication. In that very tradition, the Prophet sallallahu refers to the innate aspects of the affairs, I mean, those aspects that are unknown even by the angels. So, in the next episode, we'll try to have a look at the hindrances on the way to supplication, starting from the very tradition of the Prophet ﷺ introducing some of them to us. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
New details have emerged that pressure from big agricultural lobbies has led to the role of cattle being underplayed by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, in the rising global temperatures, global warming. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Former officials in the United Nations farming wing have said they were censored, sabotaged, undermined and victimized for more than a decade after they wrote about the hugely damaging contribution of methane emissions from livestock to global warming. Team members at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, tasked with estimating cattle's contribution to soaring temperatures, said that pressure from farm-friendly funding states was felt throughout the FAO's Rome headquarters and coincided with attempts by the Food and Agricultural Organization leadership to muzzle their work. The allegations date back to the years after 2006, when some of the officials who spoke to The Guardian on condition of anonymity wrote Livestock's Long Shadow, a landmark report that pushed farm emissions onto the climate agenda for the first time. Livestock's Long Shadow included the first tally of the meat and dairy sector's ecological cost, attributing 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions to livestock, mostly cattle. It shocked an industry that had long seen the Food and Agricultural Organization as a reliable ally and spurred an internal clampdown by FAO hierarchy, according to former officials. The lobbyists obviously managed to influence things, one former official claimed. They had a strong impact on the way things were done at the FAO, and there was a long list of censorship. It was always an uphill struggle getting the documents you produce past the Office for Corporate Communications, and one had to fend off a good deal of editorial vandalism. Serving and former FAO experts said that between 2006 and 2019, management made numerous attempts to suppress investigations into climate change connections between livestock, cattle, and climate change, top officials wrote, and diluted key passages in another report on the same topic, buried another paper critical of big agriculture, excluded critical officials from meetings and summits, and briefed against their work. There was substantial pressure internally, and there were consequences for permanent staff who worked on this in terms of their careers. It wasn't really a healthy environment to work in, according to one former official. Scientists also expressed concern about the way the Food and Agricultural Organization's estimate of livestock's overall contribution to emissions is continuing to fall. The 18% number that was published in 2006 was revised downwards to 14.5% in a follow-up paper, Tackling Climate Change Emissions in 2013. It is currently being assessed at about 11.2% based on a new GLEAM 3.0 model. But many scientists plot farm emissions on a very different trajectory. One recent study concluded that greenhouse gas emissions from animal products made up 20% of the global total, and a 2021 study found the figure should be between 16.5% and 28.1%. A recent paper by Matthew Hayek, the assistant professor in environmental sciences at New York University, said that the Food and Agricultural Organization's use of modeling rather than verifiable monitoring data could underestimate methane emissions from livestock by up to 90% in countries such as the United States. Models are only estimates that need to be constantly validated, and there's been an alarming lack of validation over the now decades that this research has been produced. Anne Motte, the FAO's livestock development officer, stressed that the changing figures reflected best practices and evolving methodologies rather than an assumed cut in livestock numbers. Livestock is part of the FAO's strategy on climate change, and we work with governments and farmers and industry on this program as well, she said. And Motte added, we can't ignore the main actors of the sector, but there has been no particular pressure from them. The new report's methodology had produced more accurate figures because we have access to better data and tools, and the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change calculations for emissions, are also being improved and updated regularly. The Guardian conducted in-depth interviews with about 20 former and current FAO officials and corroborated their accounts as far as possible. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, the officials described a culture in which attempts to probe the connection between livestock and climate change were discouraged and in some cases suppressed, and where management attempted to sabotage research and research networks. Henning Steinfeld, the head of the FAO's Livestock Analysis Unit, said diplomats and meat lobbyists talked to senior FAO managers and encouraged them not to invest in work that dealt with environmental impacts. It is not that anyone would come to you and say, stop this work, we don't like this work, the source said, describing the working environment within the Food and Agricultural Organization. They would just make your work more difficult. They would not invite you to a meeting with a donor. You would not get a slot when you should be speaking. You would not get the support from project development, from capacity building, from all kinds of other units in the FAO, and others would get that instead. Jennifer Jacquet, a professor of environmental science at University of Miami in Florida, suggested it was no coincidence that the FAO had rowed back on its appraisal of farm emissions, given the pressures recounted by former officials. It's a story as old as time, that the meat and dairy industry has enormous influence over policy-making decisions. FAO data was a prime source of data for the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change's last report on forestry and agriculture, according to its lead author, Gert Jan Naburs. The organization's current focus is on making sure that scientific innovation is made as available as possible for farmers around the world. In September, it hosted the first global conference on sustainable livestock transformation, which looked at animal feed, precision farming, and animal genetic resources. The Common Dreams website has also covered the same story and tells us more. A landmark report by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, forced global policymakers to consider greenhouse gas emissions from livestock and the corporate farming industry nearly two decades ago. And current and former officials at the agency revealed on Friday, 20th of October, that they were subjected to censorship and internal pressure from meat and dairy industry lobbyists for years afterwards, with ramifications that likely persist even today. As policymakers prepare to discuss agriculture and the climate crisis at the upcoming 2023 United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP28, between 2006 and 2019, former Food and Agricultural Organization officials claimed FAO management frequently tried to suppress further investigations into the connection between livestock, factory farming, and the global warming, the climate crisis, in an attempt to prevent the agency from building on its findings in its 2006 landmark report. Big agriculture lobbyists were a major driver of the suppression attempts, according to former FAO officials.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies.
Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone.
Please refer to our website for the details. Is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth,
son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you. You who have my roots, Palestine. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land. Your blood.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. is definitely an accomplice in Israeli crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Palestinian officials in Gaza say that Israel has dropped more than 12,000 tons of explosives on the besieged territory. The death toll tops 6,500. And pro-Palestine rallies go on across the globe, with protesters condemning Israel's brutal aggression against Gaza.